The Prime Minister has forecast more than $4 billion in cuts to our international aid budget, and that's prompted protests from church and charity leaders. He's also abolished AusAid as a standalone agency. It's now just a part of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. But does aid always help those in long-term need, or does it simply enrich corrupt officials and multinational corporations? And what are the ethical considerations that arise when a corporation swoops into a country that's been racked by disaster or conflict? Anthony Lowenstein is the author of a new book, Prophets of Doom: How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. And I spoke with him earlier.
I think one of the problems with the debate around aid often is the fact that many people on the progressive side of politics think the more aid, the better. The problem is that too often that money is A, going to waste or corruption, or it's going to Western contractors who are making a decent living out of it, but often rarely actually empowering local actors in those countries. So in, say, Afghanistan, the West has been occupying the country for 12 years. Most of the West will be pulling out by the end of 2014. What's actually going to be left there? Schools, hospitals, infrastructure is very, very little. Now, Australia is obviously a minor player in that war. The US is the main actor there. But the problem is that too often, we often have not been listening to what locals actually are wanting, what locals are saying, supporting local groups. And so I would say that in theory, cutting aid is a problem, but I think too many people don't look at actually where that aid is going.
What about the aid, for example, that immunises children or that provides mosquito nets to prevent the spread of malaria?
No argument, vital.
Because that is direct material aid, no money changes hands?
It is. I think the aid debate often is very, very narrow. One of the things I tried to do was that so much of aid has now been privatised in the last 20 or so years. And the problem also has been that we have this concept that an NGO, a non-government organisation, is by definition benign. There are some NGOs that are for profit. In fact, we've seen after, for example, the Haitian earthquake in January 2010, where there were countless, particularly US corporations that went into that country very, very quickly. And WikiLeaks documents that came out in 2010 revealed that the US ambassador at the time was very clearly talking about how corporations could make a killing from that disaster.
Mm. Well, we'll come back to Haiti because that's a principal sort of area of ground zero in this debate. Let's get to the core of your book, Prophets of Doom. Because it seems to me that the recurring theme in this book, and you say it here, is that multinational corporations, if not cause the crisis, then in your words, they entrench a crisis that only they can then resolve. Tell me about how that works.
Public service providers, which is a benign way of describing companies like Serco and G4S, listeners may have heard of these corporations, they're British. During the Howard years, the Labor years, and now the Abbott Liberal years, there was a decision made that detention centres should be outsourced to private corporations. The government made the decision that to keep them in public hands would be seen as too expensive, and the ideology, which I think started very much in the Thatcher-Reagan years, was outsourcing is good, it's efficient and cheaper. There's not much evidence for that when it comes to, say, the most vulnerable people, especially asylum seekers, particularly in Britain and here in the US.
Yes, and there was a Productivity Commission inquiry in Australia some years ago, which did raise some question marks over the efficiency of private prisons in this country.
Indeed, and the efficiency, of course, is one issue. And the other problem, which I talk about by visiting places like Curtin and Christmas Island, is that we're not just talking about money, we're talking about vulnerable lives, asylum seekers and the guards who work in those centres. So the ideology which essentially argues that ethically it makes more sense to put it in private hands and therefore it's more accountable. In fact, the opposite is true, but that benefits both sides. So when you're a journalist or a citizen, you want to find out information about what's happening in, say, Christmas Island. Both sides blame the other, and both sides say, speak to the other about getting accurate information. And that, of course, benefits both sides in the whole equation. Having it in public hands doesn't guarantee utopia. Doesn't mean that if, for example, asylum seekers were managed by the Australian government, there'd be no problems. There would be. The policy is the problem, in my view, here. But the private corporation, and I found this with speaking to a lot of whistleblowers from Serco, which is a British company that runs on the mainland, and internal documents which show that when asylum seekers were coming in greater numbers, they were spending less money on training and less money on staff. which of course is inherently a bit of a problem in terms of care for asylum seekers and the guards themselves.
Well, part of your book deals with the Curtin Detention Centre and Serco, the British company that runs a lot of private prisons. You say in your book, because you don't over-egg it, you say Curtin isn't anything like a gulag. But you do point out that it isn't ideal for Serco, for the processing of asylum seekers, to be all that quick.
Of course.
So yes, they may run, certainly not pleasant, but a completely habitable detention centre. But it isn't in their interest for the asylum seekers to disappear quickly, is it?
And one of the things, of course, that you find is that during the Labor years, of course, from 2009 to 2013, there was a surge in boats, everyone knows that, and more and more people were in detention on the mainland and elsewhere. Now, Serco, of course, didn't bring those boats. No one's arguing that. But no doubt that speaking to senior Serco managers off the record, which I talk about in my book and elsewhere, are saying this is fantastic for the bottom line. Their profits have gone up massively. In 2009, when Labor signed the contract, it was $370 million. In 2013, just before the Abbott government won election in September, the contract was $1.86 billion. Now, that's a bit of a huge jump in 4 years. And what's interesting now is with an Abbott government that the Serco contract expires in 2014. No one's quite sure what's going to happen next. But the fundamental point is that internally, Serco is actually very happy about the fact that more people are coming, and they are concerned, so I'm told, that an Abbott government may well either actually stop the boats or reduce the numbers of asylum seekers coming, which means what happens to their business model? But the problem, I think, has been that, and you see this in Britain as well in the US, countless government reports that when you, for example, particularly put asylum seekers or immigrants in these centres, in the US it's even a worst example, but there are cases of lobbyists from private prison companies who are directly influencing legislation to make sure
yes,
that certain numbers of people remain in prison.
That's correct. We did a story earlier this year on the campaign against private prisons in America based on that argument, not on a public versus private model, but specifically on that model of where lobbyists are against the liberalising of certain drug laws, not because they think drug consumption is a bad thing, but because they simply want a constant trickle of clients, in inverted commas.
And you find this in Australia as well, and nothing is illegal about this. Let me preface it by saying this, but lots of examples, mostly on the public record, of ministers from the New South Wales government, WA government, who have gone on Serco-sponsored trips to the UK to see how wonderful it is if they outsource prisons, detention centres, juvenile justice, etc. And although the Labor government, former Labor government, now federally, was wonderful at outsourcing, I suspect, based on their record state-wise and during the Howard years, the Liberals under Abbott are likely to outsource more. And that, I think, is a problem because the companies that are likely to benefit, such as Serco, have such terrible human rights records. This is not me saying this. This often is government reports themselves that are arguing this. I think it's a worry that people are very happy in certain government institutions and lobbyists to give more contracts to companies with such worrying records.
Let's cast our net a little widely. I want to look at Haiti, because after the earthquake in January 2010, all the problems of Haiti seem to be encapsulated in the words of the US ambassador, who's sending a cable back to Washington to the State Department, said, and I'm not sure he said it approvingly, maybe it was just him observing what was obviously going on, the gold rush is on. What was the gold rush in post-earthquake Haiti?
Well, it wasn't subtle, was it? This was released by WikiLeaks. Essentially, what he was arguing was that for particularly American corporations, it was boom time, that Haiti was already an arguably broken state before the earthquake. The earthquake happens, the country was in ruin, particularly around Port-au-Prince, the capital, and the evidence was that countless US corporations were bidding on the day or two after the devastating earthquake for great contracts, for-profit corporations, who often saw themselves, of course, as NGOs. So we have this idea that earthquake happens, organizations go to help, and there were wonderful groups doing essential work. And the day after an earthquake or the weeks after, it is life and death situations. But the issue is more what happens over time. So the gold rush really was that countless corporations, many of which I talk about in my book, and often for that matter, are working in other places like Afghanistan, who are over and over again failing to meet any kind of basic standards. It has no effect on getting more contracts, no effect at all. So the Haitian people are getting bugger all. Essentially, there's not infrastructure being built. There's not really any long-term planning. And when those corporations and organizations leave, what are they actually left with? Little. in reality. And I saw that when I was there last year.
Yeah, well, Haiti's a very interesting case because it also, in a sense, exemplifies this tendency of multinational corporations to come in and take advantage, historically, of undemocratic regimes. I mean, you point out in the book that all during the years of the Duvalier dictatorship, both Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier, yeah. Yeah. going really from the early 50s until the late 80s, the country was forcibly opened up to foreign competition.
This, of course, is classic US foreign policy in a way. I mean, Haiti is, in essence, in theory, independent. So is PNG, for that matter. But in reality, of course, it's still, as many Haitians themselves see, as it's a client state of the US, particularly. As you rightly say, for decades, the US-backed dictatorships, where unions and workers' rights were suppressed, where Western corporations, especially from the US, were able to particularly, for example, construct clothing and cheap goods for Western audience. Now we have a situation where Kmart and Walmart, these big multinationals, are, and I went to some of these sweatshops myself, are producing clothes for American, mostly audiences, and the conditions are pretty bad. The pay is terrible. The ability for a so-called democratic government to actually enforce any kind of labor laws are virtually non-existent. And of course, this was pushed through after the earthquake as a so-called solution. So you had a situation where Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, those who don't know, they went to Haiti on their honeymoon, which I didn't know until I read that last year. And they supposedly have a special place in their heart for Haiti. But the reality is that they assisted a South Korean company called Saya to go into Haiti and produce all these terribly crappy clothes for American clients. And in reality, this is seen as a solution to a poor country, but in fact, it actually entrenches underpaid workers indefinitely.
Yes. The other thing is, and I don't see this as an ideological book that you've written, because you point out that this kind of crony capitalism, especially multinational corporations doing deals with dictatorships, governments that don't have any popular mandate, it actually displaces local capitalism, small landholders, small storeholders.
Well, democracy, of course, is bad for business, really, isn't it? Because ultimately you could have the possibility of a government enforcing some kind of laws or regulations. And, of course, a dictatorship makes it far easier. But I think one of the things that you see in Haiti and Afghanistan and PNG is, as you rightly say, small shopkeepers, some may be surviving, many are not. And when it comes to, say, clothing manufacturers, agricultural plants and others, in fact, including tourism, it's encouraged by foreign governments. The US is but one of many to enrich foreign corporations to basically get a foothold in a country where they can far more easily make a profit. That money rarely stays in the country itself. And what the WikiLeaks documents, amongst many others, revealed is that there's actually no incentive at the moment for a Haitian government, nominally independent, although in some ways bought by the US, to actually change these policies, because they realize they're dependent on foreign aid and foreign support. So it's almost like there needs to be a greater check on power, and just finally a sense of far greater regulation about how corporations that are operating from, say, the US or here or elsewhere behave in non-Western states. That is, I think, a glaring error at the moment in our global architecture.
I want to just come back to the region, to Papua New Guinea, where you talk about the resource curse, a country that is thought to have large reserves of copper and gold and silver.
Huge.
Huge reserves. Normally one would think that this would be to the great benefit of the people. You quote Hillary Clinton in a very honest moment when she said, look, let's not be warm and fuzzy about this. PNG is a location, is one of those locations where the United States is in a contest for influence with China.
Indeed. Very honest by Hillary. Surprisingly so, in fact, when she was Secretary of State, of course.
But the point there being, Anthony, that this is part of just a bigger game or what?
One of the things, and just in summary, is that I saw in PNG particularly was that Australia sees PNG as its baby. Of course, Australia used to control the country till 75, and it's now nominally independent, but I would argue in some ways very much still reliant on outside forces. China wants influence in our region, amongst other places like Africa, and they are increasingly supporting a PNG government. They're putting money into infrastructure. They are trying to buy various mining interests. Now, their human rights record is bloody awful as well. But what's happening is that in places like PNG, you find that almost as a battle between competing forces. Now, between China and Australia, for example, China's going to win. I mean, it's as simple as that at the moment. And between America and China, it's a bit of a different story. But one of the things I was looking at, particularly in Bougainville, as I said, was a mine during its time being open in the 70s and 80s, which was one of the biggest mines in the world, copper and gold. Civil War was fought. Various countries, including Australia, backed Rio Tinto and others to suppress the insurgency. The insurgency won at a crazy cost. Fast forward to 2013 and onwards, and you do find China investing in various mines themselves, in very, very polluting mines. And I think the problem has been that a country like PNG is sort of stuck in the middle. You have various forces trying to get influence in a country which is resource rich, very, very resource rich. And the problem is that in so many, I don't think there's any country I can think of, and feel free to correct me on this, a developing country with huge resources, which generally speaking massively benefits the locals from those resources.
Yeah, well, let me just anticipate the critique here, Anthony, that, oh, but hang on, these, you know, these companies that go in and mine in developing countries, it has a flow-on effect, surely. Yep. It creates other employment. Isn't that...
That argument's made, and there's no doubt in parts of PNG there are certain roads and schools that wouldn't maybe have existed without that. That is undeniably true. But the problem is in virtually every country I can think of, PNG, Afghanistan, where there's a potential mining boom, that some locals benefit, the vast majority do not. Corruption is rife. Environmental destruction is off the scale, and you see that in PNG. So, yes, are there any benefits from mining in some countries? Undeniably, yes. But I would say the flip side is that in so many examples, there's little or no accountability of the corporations themselves that are operating there. They come to local landholders, and I heard this in PNG over and over again, Andrew, saying, promising, we'll build schools and hospitals. Mm. And the government's not providing that, but so often that doesn't actually happen in practice. Mm.
Well, that is the central story of the new book by author Anthony Lowenstein, Prophets of Doom. It's published by Melbourne University Press. It's a provocative and fascinating and extremely well footnoted book, I have to say.
Indeed.
Anthony Lowenstein, author of Prophets of Doom, thank you for joining us on the Religion
Andrew.
And Ethics Report.
Thank you.
And that interview with Anthony and our earlier interview with Frank Bongiorno will be up on our website soon. You can download or stream them. We're at the RN website. You can leave a comment. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at ABC Religion. A big thanks to our producer, Jess Hill, and our technical producer, Paul Gough. And coming up in a couple of weeks, an interview with the British conservative writer and provocateur, Peter Hitchens. He's coming to Australia soon to discuss his new book about the war on drugs that actually never took place for the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. That is a dangerous idea. But next, it's breakfast.